I ran my Roomba today, and I actually ran it twice because I had forgotten and haven't done it in a while. And after emptying that bin a couple times, I now feel like the grossest of human beings.
Every time I think of a Roomba, I think of that security robot that drove into a pool and drowned itself.
I just imagine it going back to its little docking station, and as it pulls in, it just lets out a sigh, and it's just like. Well, hello, designers and designerettes. You are listening to the Drunken UX Podcast. This is episode number 35.
You mean 34?
Well,
35.
It is 35. I updated one title, not the other one, when I copied the files. It's you know what? This is what we call a good problem to have, right? That we've now done enough episodes that it's starting to get confusing as to which number we're on if we don't check. So, I'm all right with that. So let's see.
How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm one of the hosts of the show. If you haven't heard us before, or this is your first time listening to us, my name is Michael Feenan.
Hello, Michael. My name is Aaron Hill. I'm also hosting the show. It's nice to meet you.
We enjoy Aaron's presence. He is a light of our life, and he sits in his room. I get to watch him in these chats, and I can see all of his kids' pictures hanging up behind him, and.
Yeah, so some of those are from them. Some of them are pages I've colored.
And oh, wait, what?
I color stuff. I like adult coloring or grown-up coloring books, not adult coloring books. That's a different kind of thing.
Oh, I've only got one thing on my wall back behind me, and you'd commented on this before because you've seen it in the background, but you never knew what it was.
Yeah.
I don't have a kid, so I don't have drawings or anything, but I do have a Judas Priest record that is
right.
Sad Wings of Destiny, and so that's framed and up on my wall.
It's funny, you posted a photo of your desk on Twitter the other day, and that was the first time I had ever seen the other side of your room before. Yeah. And so I was like connecting the dots, like, oh, okay, wait, I know where that corner is and that corner.
I have an accent wall. Yeah, so folks, episode number 35 of the Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends over at NewCloud. They do interactive maps, illustrations. They have a whole platform that you can embed stuff on your site. Go check them out if you're looking for anything interactive map related, for whether it's a school, city, hospital. I'm sure they would do a theme park or your backyard if you really wanted to. Really big haunted house, sure. There's one up in Kansas City that's like two haunted houses side by side. Apparently it's like supposed to be one of the best ones in the country. I don't know. I've been there
nice.
At one point.
So you just get scared half to death on one side, and then the other side they finish the job.
Yeah, hopefully. that's the one you go into and like you don't get to come out of unless you right. sign a release and all this, and
they literally murder you.
Yeah. So if you want to check us out, go by either Instagram at DrunkenUXPodcast, or you can catch us on Twitter or Facebook at /DrunkenUX. If you want to chat with us at some point, feel free to drop into Slack at DrunkenUX.com/Slack, and that'll get you right in, and we would love to sit and have a chat with you at any point.
Hello to Virginia de Guzman, who has recently joined the chat room and has been talking to us. So when you finally get up to this episode, hi.
I don't know how far in she is yet, so it may be a few hours. So let's see. I just want to, before we get into everything else, I did want to give a shout out to one of our listeners, Mike Henderson. We always say, you know, if we get something wrong, to let us know. And Mike sent us a message on Twitter, and we were talking about accessibility in color palettes with Gutenberg, and I made the comment that they didn't have a contrast checking on the color palette selector.
Right.
That is, in fact, not true, and hasn't been for quite a while, as it turns out.
Oh, no.
I am just dumb on that, and that's all that amounts to. So, shout out to Mike for calling us out on that, and I did want to issue a public statement, because I don't want the folks at WordPress to be angry at us, and all of that, because I didn't want to misrepresent them. So they do, if you go in and play with their color palettes, and I was looking at it, it does pop up a thing that If you select two colors, it will warn you that it has potential contrast issues. So that,
cool.
that is, in fact, a solved problem on that front.
Well done, WordPress.
Well done, WordPress. Whether you like Gutenberg or not, they did that part good. What are you drinking?
I've got some Stoli crushed pineapple vodka with a splash of orange juice in it. It's not bad.
I used to love Stoli. I do. I mean, I don't not like Stoli. But I definitely, when they started putting out like all the flavors, that was kind of one of those moments that was like, yeah, not so sure. It's like, you don't see Grey Goose cherry, you know?
The Stoli's flavored, and we're obviously not sponsored by Stoli, but their flavored vodkas, I think, are the better or best of the flavored vodkas. Like, I don't like Absolut's flavored vodkas. I love their marketing, and their regular vodka is fine, but, like, the flavored vodkas just don't sit well.
It's the flavored stuff is always ends up coming out really sugary.
Yeah.
It's kind of like they, and I mean, it really is. It's just grain alcohol and Kool-Aid.
When I used to serve tables, our bar manager would always say, like, if someone ever orders a mudslide, upsell them on getting Stoli Vanilla in it. It was just, you know, a dollar or two upcharge. Because it's really, it makes it taste better. Because the, and it really does, too. I mean, it's subtle, but it's good.
And I can see that. That's probably fair. I'm old enough now that it's like, I don't do much flavored. the one thing I'll have is, and I've had it on the show, of course, is the gingerbread, which has Fireball in it. And it's like, I'm not going to shoot Fireball or something. That's just, that's humiliating. Let's face it. But, and it does, there's so much sugar in it that it just is not good. But as like a component to something, I can see it. And same with the flavored vodkas. Like, if you just want something sweet and flavored, then go for it. But I'm past the age of shooting any of that. That's for darn sure.
what do you got?
I'm over here with my Bowmore 12. I've said many times I'm not a big fan of Islay scotches, but Bowmore is not bad. It's still strong, and I took a sip of it to get started here, and it definitely... It still has a good little sock in the mouth, but it's still generous in its flavor. Like, it's not overpowering, and it's definitely not like a Laphroaig or an Ardbeg that have just this really, like, it doesn't have that iodine flavor that comes from the peat. It's got a smoky flavor that stands kind of apart and on its own.
So a couple episodes ago, you listeners probably don't know, but we had to do a whole bunch of retakes and a whole bunch of pauses.
Hey, now.
Because the scotch was kicking your ass. Hey,
that is a patented lie. I don't know what he's talking about.
I think that was one of those things where you thought you were more drunk than you were. Or maybe it was just like the alcohol was making the difficult to connect thoughts. I've definitely had a couple episodes with guests where I just kind of zone out and I'm like, wait, what were we talking about?
Hey, these are the risks we run. I can't say anything more than that. That's what makes it fun. That's why I hope you tune in. Speaking of drunk humans, though, I want to talk for a second. This is just totally weird and random, and it came up in one of my dev chats today. This Instagram post is going around, and I don't know if folks have seen it, and if you haven't, I'll have it linked in the show notes on the website, so stop by drunkenux.com, and you'll be able to see this. It's a chimp, and so there's this chimp, and they gave the chimp a cell phone with Instagram on it, and the video is absolutely enthralling, because this chimp is sitting there looking at Instagram, and using Instagram.
Yeah.
If you didn't
see that it was a chimp, like if you just cover the right side of the screen, you would think it was like a kid with a really wrinkly hand.
And I thought for a minute, like, oh, well, this is just, you know, somebody has done some good CG. Because people do that. You know, you've seen this on Instagram. But
sure,
it's a verified account. It's not just some random, like, I don't know, the real Tarzan. I don't know who that is. But it's probably somebody super famous that I should know. Let me see. It's Mike Hull Holston, Mike Holston. Animal education and conservation. Doesn't seem like the type of dude who would fake videos. So yeah. I'm going to take it at its word. And so they've opened up, I don't know if it's his feed or somebody, it's clearly a wildlife animal feed. And it starts with this chimp is watching a little video, an Instagram video of another monkey. Well, I don't know if it's a chimp or what it is. I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I build websites. I don't don't do animals. So it may be a monkey. I don't know. What are the types? An orangutan? I don't think it's an orangutan.
That's a chimp.
A chimpanzee.
Yeah.
That's the scientific word. So he's watching it, and
yeah.
You can tell like he's actively. It's not just like staring at the screen, you know, how like animals will, so like a dog or a cat will sometimes stare at a TV, but they're not necessarily watching it.
But then he clicks out and starts swiping upwards to go through the feed, and then he taps on a photo or an image, and then he's viewing that one, and then he goes back and does the same thing again.
He understood the flow of the app and was making, I think the thing that really makes it like super bizarre is you realize that he is making active choices as to which ones he wanted to look at.
There are preferences and desires being expressed through his interactions. Yeah.
And to make this valuable to the listeners at home, this, whether you like Instagram or don't like Instagram, I'm not here to judge, but it really says a lot about the usability of the thing you have made. If you can hand it to an animal, even if it's a super smart animal, and they can use and understand that interface, like that says something, you know, about the barrier to entry, so to speak.
When my kids were really little, my son was about 3, I think, and we got him this little like digital camera that it was like 800 by 600 pixels or whatever, and really durable frame. But it was fascinating to see the things that he would go around and take pictures of. You know, it would be like some of his toys or like a show he was watching, or a lot of pictures of the fish, pictures of me and his mom, and of the cat. And it would just like, it would be things that he wanted to kind of save or that he felt were important to take pictures of. And I would love to see what a chimp, like, give the chimp the camera app.
Yeah.
And what does it take pictures of? That's what I want to see.
It also reminds me of things like, if you've seen that video of a chimp at a zoo, and a person is sitting in the window with them with a cup and is doing like a real simple magic trick. Just a very simple, like, put something under the cup, make it vanish, and show that there's nothing in the cup.
Yeah.
And the chimp, you know, their ability to establish object permanence is such that when he showed, hey, there's nothing in the cup, the chimp was like, ah, that's hilarious. like they understood a thing happened. There's so much to that. I don't know. It's just very, it's very neat. Go look at the video if you haven't seen it yet, because I do think that it's an interesting thing. And I guess, and you say like kids, don't they say,
yeah,
chimps are basically like a 3-year-old child or something like that, like on a intelligence level.
Yeah, I could see that.
So
yeah,
there's definitely something to be said there, especially when you think about user interfaces and usability. So the other thing though that we wanted to just kind of start off and see it in here, being that it's the end of April, this will be the last episode for the month. All of you by this point, and many of you who are, you know, freelance web developers or anything like that, or have done moonlighting or all this stuff, are probably painfully aware of the process of getting your 1099s together, getting, you know, if you've got a Schedule C or something like this, and trying to file your taxes online. ProPublica had an article they put out about TurboTax and their use of dark patterns to basically trick you into paying for software that you don't need. This was something I complained about on Twitter actually very recently as well. So the timing on this is all very auspicious from a subject standpoint. I'll throw some of that in the show notes too, but the way in which tax software now approaches its users is bordering on, in my opinion, unethical. And it makes me sad as a web developer to know that there are web developers not pushing back against the things they are doing in those platforms.
Well, so I filed my taxes by hand from age 14 until, probably like 27 or 28, maybe, was the first time I e-filed. And knowing how to make those decisions and everything, it's really complicated. It's not easy. I mean, it's definitely doable. You don't need to go to a professional if your tax situation isn't too complicated, but it's not easy by any means. And so there's a lot of opportunities for a company to bamboozle a customer into thinking they need something that they don't.
And so for like our web developer friends out there that do a lot of freelancing of any kind, or if you're self-employed in general, and this goes back to like our episode with Joel Goodman talking about starting your own web business. You know, if you are your own entity, so to speak, and you are filing, if you've got even a very small like sole proprietor LLC, you're probably filing all your income under your 1040, which is perfectly legitimate and appropriate. That one of the things that TurboTax was getting called out on is you get to the end of their funnel and they would say, oh, you are doing all this stuff about being self-employed. You need to pay for our $120, you know, advanced self-employment platform instead. And they, you know, they get you through the whole process before they tell you any of that. And the reality is that from a legal standpoint, the IRS has an agreement with many of these companies that if you make under $66,000 a year, you do not have to pay to file your taxes, period.
Right.
Like, no, like that's not, there's no complicated thing about it. That's just the rule.
So just to establish, in this case, I do actually have a degree in accounting, so I can actually say this with some authority that you don't have to pay to file your taxes if you do them yourself, like by hand with paper and submit it by mail. It's free, totally free to file, like, state and federal.
You have to pay for a stamp.
Okay, yeah. You have to pay for a stamp, but otherwise it's totally free. So there's no, like, they're not covering some cost that you would have had to pay otherwise. Second thing is that TurboTax is not the only game in town. There's a whole bunch of them. I think we'll have a link. Yeah, we do. We have a link in the show notes for a site where you can go to find all the other tax filing options for who else can file your things online. I don't use TurboTax. I used 1040.com this year, which seems like it would be official because it has 1040 in the URL, but they're, I mean, it's another private company. It was a good UI though. Like, I had a good experience. I've used other services before.
I haven't used 1040.com before. I'll have to check that out. Somebody recommended, I think it's TaxHawk to me. Was one. I've used TaxAct since the early 2000s. But even they have fallen prey to this use of dark patterns, and like it cost me over $70 to file all my taxes this year after paying the federal filing fee, the state filing fee. Now I don't fall under that free filing limit, but there is a link that'll be in the show notes to the free file listing from the IRS that gives you a list of all the services that will let you file for free and the deal. It's weird though, because that list also includes a lot of very strange exceptions. Some of them are just like, yeah, if you make under $66,000, you file for free, here's how. But then others have different limits and different conditions, and I don't know legally why that is the case, because it was part of a settlement kind of thing that they put together with the tax prep people.
The link has a form that with some pretty basic questions that you probably will know the answer to if you've ever filed your taxes before.
Sure.
And those questions will tell you which of the forms will apply to you for free filing. Generally, if you make under $66,000 and you do like a 9-to-5 job and you get a W-2 at the end of the year and you don't have anything weird like, you know, buying and selling property or doing a whole lot of stuff with stocks or whatever, you'll probably be able to qualify for the free filing.
Yeah. Anyway, let's go though, because here's the thing with the dark patterns. Some of the stuff that, not just Tax Act, but all, you know, all these folks, H&R Block, TurboTax, all these folks were doing. One is the way they were doing their SEO and keyword bidding. So if you tried to do a search for something like IRS file free, or file free taxes or something like that, you would get results, of course, but like the top 4 or 5 results would be one of those Google ad panels.
Yeah.
And they would all link you into their funnel. That would not give you free taxes, or free filing, rather.
Right.
That's
well, because they're trying to make money off of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so there's in the ProPublica article, there's this comment. It turns out if you start the process from TurboTax.com, it's impossible to find the truly free version. And the company itself admits this. And what they did was they went in and looked, and they were actually looking at like the cookies and the local storage stuff that was getting set. And they found a value that was getting set that literally defined you regardless of how you started your taxes. If you started on TurboTax.com, it flagged you as a non-free filer. And so even if you click the button that says, I'm going to file my taxes for free, you are, it's a carnival game. That's what it is, right? It's a total carnival game that they are dangling a prize in front of you that you can never really win.
So there's another ProPublica article, and I thought this was the one we were linking to, but it's not. So I just added it to the show notes, but Intuit, the company that makes TurboTax, has been lobbying the government to stop you from being able to do free e-filing. You would still be able to file by manually by hand, but e-filing, like electronic filing, they're trying to make it where you have to go through a third party.
Yeah, and try to go through their checkout process as a consequence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They've done stuff like the naming, the nomenclature of this. I mean, on one hand, it's like, it's brilliant, but it's also insidious. Because the naming, if you go to TurboTax, they have a product called Free Edition.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron, what would you expect the Free Edition to be? Let me just...
I'm waiting.
Just throw it out there. I mean, what do you think the Free Edition implies?
I think that if it says Free Edition, it's probably be no money. It should probably not have a cost associated with it.
And of course it is, but again, it's like any weirdly good deal. It's like if you are not absolutely meeting every checkbox on a 12-point list, you don't qualify, and most people don't. Because the Free Edition is not the Free Edition as defined by the IRS. Huh. Their version of that is called the Freedom Edition. And so they have deliberately misnamed the products in such a way that the way you would search for it, the way you would look for that information and the nomenclature the user uses is being actively used against them in the platform and on the website.
Yeah.
I mean, that's I said to start, it's unethical at the very least, in my opinion.
I know that other articles have been much more strongly worded about this, but there are alternatives to TurboTax. TurboTax is doing bad things here, and I would never recommend them to anyone. There are plenty of good alternatives that do just a fine job. I won't say which one you should use. That's up to you, but maybe don't use TurboTax.
It all reminds me, and it doesn't, I mean... Like I said, I don't use TurboTax. I use TaxAct, but I still see the same stuff. It all comes down to this very... Anybody who's ever used GoDaddy, which at some point we do. I don't know why that's a weird rite of passage, but at some point we've all had to deal with GoDaddy. But their approach to upselling and trying to trick you into paying for things, like, you know, if you want a privacy guard on your DNS registration.
Yeah.
You know, what does that cost through GoDaddy? Like $10, $12 a year, something extra.
Oh my gosh, really?
I don't know.
That much?
It may not be, and I may be wrong on that, and don't take that as word. But they charge extra for Privacy Guard.
Wow.
Google doesn't. That's literally part of what you're paying for. Like, it's just free.
It never used to cost any money. I remember I used to register domains through Dreamhost, and like, you know, the Whois privacy anonymization was always part of it. It was just a recent thing when they made it be like an upcharge.
Yeah, and I mean, I may have that wrong. It may be much cheaper than that. But the fact of the matter is they try to upsell you on it, which is not great. What the tax software does, and like what I saw in TaxAct, they're like, hey, let us run these reports for you. And, you know, we'll do this planning. We'll offer you these planning services for your next year. And that is an extra service they want to charge you for. If you have to attach extra forms, that's where they start funneling you into all of these other versions of their product. Adding on states or anything is always extra. My favorite one is the audit protection. And they're like, here, pay us extra and we'll give you audit protection. And I just want to look at them and be like, what are you, the fucking mob?
Okay, so, all right. I actually paid for that this year. It was the first time I ever did, and the only reason was because my I had some inheritance last year and some other stuff, and the tax situation was weird, and I wanted to just, it was like $30, and I was like, you know what? It's just $30, peace of mind.
Sure.
I'll take
it. And I think, you know, in certain circumstances, I'm sure it's well worth it. And if you're paying for tax preparation, you probably should pay for that or have it, you know, as part of the package. I would argue if you feel like you need that level of protection, you probably should go to an actual...
You should do an accountant.
Yeah, you should actually go to a tax accountant and have them do it for you. Because most of the time, they do include that protection as part of what you're paying for.
There's a line on the 1040 that says if it's a paid preparer, then the paid preparer has to sign it separately.
And the thing comes down to, like, when you get to these pages, it's always in the final steps. It's always in, like, the I'm ready to e-file point. Mm-hmm. And it's always a case of, like, a big button to continue, quote unquote, or the little text link that says, no thanks, I waive protection.
Right.
And so it's like they're doing all of these little things to try and trick you. They keep stopping you. That's the other part, is they keep interrupting your experience and trying through fatigue to convince you to click a certain button or take a certain action that will result in you paying them more money.
I'm surprised they don't word it like yes, I want to be protected, or no, I'll handle my own audit.
Right. Yeah.
I just for listeners, you're probably not ever going to get audited unless your tax situation is really weird. It's the IRS, because funding for doing audits has gotten reduced a lot in the past few years.
They have almost no capacity to do audits anymore, and it means they only go after people who's got, like, they have income deviations that are, like, off the charts kind of stuff.
If your tax situation, like, basically, like, if your tax situation is such that a computer could flag you as, like, likely needing an audit, for example, if you have a lot of weird deductions, or if you have a business that mysteriously wipes out all of your income because of deductions or something like that, then you're more likely to get an audit. But if you're making a good faith effort to file your taxes, like, chances are, if you get any kind of audit at all, it'll just be a form letter that says, like, oh, hey, you owe us an extra $100 or $2 or whatever. Yeah. I had that happen a couple of years ago. I forgot. Missed the 1099.
I mean, it all comes down. I know this is kind of a ranty way to start the show, and I apologize to the listeners for that. But it is something that I think reflects an ethical obligation as web developers. And I've talked about this before, and I think it really shows up in cases like this when dark patterns come into play, especially in a service that everybody has to use. And even though, yes, you can absolutely file by paper, most people don't want to do that because it is a lot of extra.
It's a pain in the ass.
It's a lot of extra work.
Just a PSA on that note, though, if you have a simple tax situation, like I mentioned earlier, if you do a 9-to-5 job, you just collect a W-2 and that's it, go to your post office for tax season and look for a 1040EZ form.
Yeah.
1040EZ. If your situation is just a little bit weirder, like maybe you have student loan interest or something you're deducting, 1040A. Those are both very simple. You don't have to save your receipts or anything like that. You just find the numbers in the boxes and you fill them out on the form. You do some very simple math that you can do on a calculator or on a piece of paper. And then you sign it and mail it in. It should take you 30 minutes to an hour.
And
most.
Here's the real crux of this situation is that all of these companies, H&R Block, TurboTax, TaxAct, Intuit, take your pick, all of them have a vested interest in ensuring that you think it is too complicated to do your taxes yourself.
Yeah.
And that you can't trust yourself to accomplish that math. They have a vested financial monetary interest in making you feel that. And you have to resist that, whether it's in their commercials, in the calls to action on their website, whatever that case may be. Trust yourself more than them in those situations.
Well, their revenue models are based on selling these services and upcharging, and they make more profit if they get more upsold services or premium services. So.
I promised I wasn't going to go like political on this point, but it is.
It's not political,
but it comes back to this idea that these companies, they're part of the reason our tax code is so complicated, because again, yeah. they have a vested interest in that. They can afford to make sure that they have ways to work out that math. And the more complicated it is and the more systems it takes to figure it all out, the better off they are, because they know that they convince people that they can't handle it on their own. And they have to create that dependency, otherwise the model doesn't work.
One last PSA. If you do freelancing or you collect 1099 income, file your quarterlies. Mm. Don't pay the penalty.
Yeah.
And if you do end up owing money to the IRS, you can set up a payment plan. They will give you, I believe, 4 months, like until August, with no interest at all. And then if you need to go beyond that, the interest rate is very manageable. So don't feel like you have to put yourself out, and certainly don't put it on a credit card, because they're going to be paying more in interest.
Yeah, that's really important for folks who do any kind of freelancing. And while this may, you know, the idea of dark patterns is one thing, but the idea of just tax issues in general is another.
Yeah.
I do think that's really important for people who do a lot of freelance web development to think about, because that I've had years where I've done like consulting contracts on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we're talking like five figures worth of consulting work that adds up. And if you don't pay those and the quarterly tax thing, like you can complain about like education and all that all you want to about, well, they don't teach mm-hmm. you how to do taxes and one of the things that you really don't learn about until you've sat down and talked to other people is that idea of quarterly taxes. That's something that until you realize it's a thing, it's not something that just comes up, you know? So the end point of this we're getting into our real topic, this idea of ethics in web development. And the thing I said on Twitter the other day was this idea of, I feel like as an industry, we almost need a Hippocratic oath as web developers, because we mm-hmm. have nothing else that keeps us in check when it comes to marketing and business decisions affecting the things that we build. And this idea that I'm going to build the thing that I'm being paid to build is a very damaging mentality to take on, because it's very turnkey mm-hmm. and it makes you not think about the consequences. And at the end of the day, web developers are literally the last line of defense between the thing mm-hmm. people, you know, the business thing people want to build and the thing that is right for users.
I know you're a fan of Larry Lessig, the guy behind the Creative Commons and also ran for president at least once. He had a thing for the Root Strikers nonprofit ran. Which was I forget the name of the pledge, but it was like a few bullet point items, and Congress people and other representative government people could assert, I pledge, or I will not do this, like I will not take money from these people, or I will not do these things. It would be cool to have something like that for web developers, you know, just with a very short, like half dozen items of kind of some ethical things that we will abide by as web developers, and kind of just, you know, asserting these things.
And because I don't want to call out developers and the folks who have built these systems and things like that, but at the end of the day, you did build it. You know, it's the Oppenheimer quote, right? And now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. Like, he understood the consequence of building the bomb, so to speak. Like, that was a big deal, and the impact of that was not lost on him. And I think as web developers, mm-hmm. while we're not building nuclear weapons to, you know, wipe out cities, and that's boy, this metaphor is going weird. But we do, I think we do have that ethical obligation to consider the things we are building, how it impacts people and how it impacts business. That's all.
Yeah.
Man, dude, can we change this subject?
Yes. I'm really excited to talk about our next topic. It's going to...
Yeah, because it's all about government.
Well, no, because it's going to expand... So, like, the last episode, we expanded on web components, and we talked also about...
Which extended on the previous talk on the Hacks Editor and what they were doing. We're like chaining. We're false multiplying.
Yeah. So we also, last episode, we also talked about accessibility with design systems. Right. And this time we're going to talk about the design system that the U.S. government built called the USWDS 2.0. Right.
So,
and this, say what you will about the U.S. government, but like, this is cool.
The stuff I have so far, and with the folks I've talked to there and all this, like, I have nothing but good things to say about the folks who have done work at the USDS. That's the United States Digital Services. It's a department of the federal government now. They work kind of like, it's kind of like the Peace Corps, sort of. Like, people go there and, like, work stints, basically. Like, a year, they'll work a year on contract or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they'll go and they put teams together and they send these teams out to places like the VA or something like that. And they say, hey, we're going to help you with your website. We're going to fix it. And these are folks that are genuinely good at what they do. These aren't like, you know, the way we have a thought about web development from a government standpoint, like, it's frequently not good. I hate to say that, but I mean, there is this idea that, right, the people who, it's kind of like that, the people who can't do teach mentality. You know, the people who can't really do web development end up in government web development jobs, which is not fair, but it was for a while.
I mean, we talked about healthcare.gov, although in the defense there, healthcare.gov was done by a third-party contractor.
And the front end versus the back end there is, I think, an important distinction.
Yeah. Having, as someone who worked in web development in the government, I can say that there are smart people, many smart people that work in there. And I'm excited to see this product because it's really neat. It's a design system like we talked about last episode.
Yeah, so last episode we were talking about this idea of how web components can help you build a design system and the value that they add there. In 2015, USDS stepped up and said, hey, government websites are bad. They aren't working well. They aren't fulfilling the contracts with the users from a usability standpoint. Let us help. And so they came out with the first version of their design system. And at that point in time, it was very much like a foundation or bootstrap kind of system. They had a pattern library. They had a few different philosophical points mixed in and things like that. They brought in some ideas like accessibility and how that works in and how to, you know, make that part of your process. And they tried to put together this package. And at that point, even, it was good. Like, it was for its time.
It was very serviceable.
Oh, yeah. It was entirely usable. Yeah. It was open source on GitHub. So if anybody wanted to go and play with it or adjust it or help with it, they could certainly do that. That's actually something that I've kind of been interested in, but I need more hours in my day. Like, I think it'd be very cool to go in and sit down with that repo and look at it. And they do public calls where you can sit in and listen to what they're working on. So in the last couple of weeks, they announced that the 2.0 has finally gone gold for them.
Yeah.
It has included, I'm just going to read the list here, it has incremental adoption, so you can basically bring it into a project and use the pieces you need. Very much like a foundation. If you use NPM or something to build a foundation project, you can import it and then turn on just the parts that you want. They've introduced it practical design tokens, functions, and mix-ins. Again, trying to focus on the small bits and just what you need. Accessible color system. Where have we heard that before? expressive theming, which is an attachment to this idea of they don't want to break up or disrupt the existing layouts and templates of sites that exist currently. And so they have built in these catches and hooks so that you can bring in existing stuff very easily.
Right, because it doesn't need to be grayscale or olive drab or boring colors. Right. Like, it's colors free. Like, we can use whatever color we want.
utility classes, that's something we've seen many places. They've gone to a 12-column simplified layout grid. I have feelings about grids, but that's a topic for another time.
Wait, before you get to the next point, because it's a really big one, and I don't want to interrupt it, but on the WDS, on the design system site, they have a page called Design Principles.
Right.
It's got a lot of content on here. I just want to read the headings. If you, listeners, if you recall our guest episode with Greg Pudenovich, which I know we go back to all the time.
It's a good episode. But
it was a good episode. That was one of the ones where I spaced out. Greg was talking for like a couple minutes.
We had a lot of martinis that night.
Yeah. Well, anyways, so we were talking about design philosophies, and it was just sort of like the overarching like principles or like almost ethos that you have regarding your like direction with design. So this is the design principles for this design system. Put user needs first. Make it easy to do the right thing. Accessibility is fundamental. Start from existing solutions. Be consistent, not static, and share what we do. And that's it. Those six things.
You know what? I think one of the big ones there, that be consistent, not static.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't feel like much when you say it, but when you think about it from a how you do work standpoint,
mm-hmm.
it really starts to mean a lot, I think.
Yeah.
And this idea of consistency doesn't mean not changing.
Right. Right.
You know, as you become more fluent in a language, a foreign language or something, like, you're still you. You're still using your own vernacular and your own inflection and technique, but you get better. You get
mm-hmm.
you get smarter about how you do things. And that growth is necessary. You are still consistently you, but you haven't stayed static. You haven't stayed in that sort of very base level of thinking about the language.
Yeah. And
I think that's how that translates into a design system.
Right. So I interrupted. You're about to talk about this last item that I think is super cool.
You're fine. Wait, I'm gonna skip because there actually is one after that, but I don't have any. I have no bullet points after that one. It's a stable foundation that is built to help grow. Which
yeah.
sure it is. Of course, everything is. So the one though, and this is silly, but it's also fun. They have introduced the Public Sans typeface. Public Sans. So, you know, yeah. we've got Open Sans, we've got all of these different open license sans serif fonts. And they came out and said, you know what, we're going to do our own too. I'm going to link it. There's an article in the show notes from Vice, of all places, but they wrote up some details on this font. And it's an interesting idea. It does make sense from the standpoint of them trying to express their own sort of standard, and they wanted a typeface that would reflect the scalability that they wanted across all of their governmental properties, which is vast.
Right.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
It's public. Like Open Sans is one thing, but like Public Sans, like I just like how that sounds.
Yeah.
Like it's like the sans serif font that belongs to all of us, but they released it. They could have done it as like public domain, right? They could have just said, this is public domain, anyone can use it. But they didn't. They used the OSI. They used the Open Source Initiative license. So it's under the Open Font license. So it is like using an official, you know, tech community flagship standard that's sort of like not owned by any governmental body. Like the Open Source Initiative is just like collectively owned by all of us. And they released it under that license, and I think that's really neat.
It goes back to that idea, right, of the folks who are working at USDS, they're on their game. Like, these aren't just random guys that got hired and decided to do development. Like, these are folks who are looking towards, they still have 30 years of career ahead of them in many cases. Like,
oh, yeah.
They're young, they're engaged, they're enthusiastic, and they care about the way work is done.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I don't get, I'm going to read this quote, because...
yeah, I don't know about this.
My response to this typeface was probably what a lot of folks will look at, and is like, just why? What's the point in having your own typeface when there are so many out there? There is a quote from them, and this is quoted in this Vice article. It says, during the U.S. Web Design System 2.0 development process, it became clear that this typeface could be a useful target for our font normalization feature, the GSA spokesperson explained. since other faces are normalized to the optical size of Public Sans and common system fonts of USWDS 2.0, using Public Sans in our design file ensures that when designs go into production, the balance of the type hierarchy remains similar, even if the chosen font eventually changes. In other words, Public Sans is somewhat of an internal test case for USWDS 2.0's ability to adapt whatever typeface a designer may wish to use into the visual language of the rest of the USWDS framework. What the fuck does that mean?
I don't get that,
like,
either.
Like, I get that, you know, fonts scale differently and things like that, and I think that's kind of what it's dealing with. But at the same time, I really don't understand, like, when you start talking about using whatever font the designer wants to use, well, if other fonts scale differently because of, you know, where their baseline is, because I've got some fonts that I have a real, it's not a love-hate relationship, it's just a hate-hate relationship with, and how they play in practice. I don't fully understand that as the explanation for why they did their own typeface.
I like the quote that's further on in that paragraph, and that describes the Public Sans as simple, neutral, and isn't Helvetica.
Nothing wrong with Helvetica.
Nothing wrong at all.
At least
but
it's not,
like,
Verdana.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a couple other things of dealing with font that was very interesting to me as part of this. One was their introduction of type scale. So with type scale, and if you've used other CSS frameworks, and we've got this baked into ours as kind of a convention that we did ourselves, but, you know, it's basically this idea of having, like, size small, size medium, size large, size extra large, and you set, like, not break points, but, like, stopping points for each of those.
Right.
They've introduced a scale system that has 20 steps in it. So you dynamically, if you use their design system, you can go in and say at each stop, you know, at large, I want my scale to be 8. At, you know, double X large, I want it to be 16. At small, I want it to be 4. And so you can use that scale as a means of controlling the way it sizes abstractly.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of that I found... my initial reaction, and I really hope. And
wait, before you say what it is, let's call back to our episode with Tatiana Mack, where she said that your site should have a font size of 16 pixels. That's the readable font size, 16 pixels.
Right,
Michael.
I get it. I am getting old. I understand. When I said this, and to his credit, Aaron had the same reaction I did, and I hope some of our listeners do. The root font size in USWDS is 10 pixels.
Yeah. 10, which is not 16. It's not smaller 16. Than 16.
But after I at my initial reaction was, what? And then it almost instantly made sense.
Right.
Because now... every rem calculation you do in your CSS is based on a 10x multiplier. So if you need 16-point font, your rem calculation is 1.6. If you need a 53-pixel font, your rem is 5.3. It's actually kind of brilliant, and I'm really disappointed that it has never occurred to me to do that. Because, right, so many of us, we always, and, like, take Foundation. If you use Foundation, I believe its base font is 14 pixels.
Right.
It may be 16 now, but I think it's still 14. So, sorry if I'm wrong on that. Point is the same. If you then need a 27-pixel font, what's the rem calculation on that off the top of your head? From 14?
14 to what?
If your base is 14 and you need 27, what's the rem calculation off the top of your head? Come on.
1.5. Or no.
Nope.
That would be 21. God, 14 to 27?
Yeah, see? Because that's what we get. That's the kind of things we get handed by designers sometimes. You open up your Envision sketch or your Envision deal, your sketch, or XD, or whatever the case may be, and you get these specs that are like, wait, what font did you use?
Just under 1.8, I think.
Yeah, it's a weird number, and it's not something you can just rattle off.
Right.
But if your base is 10 and you need 27, the calculation is 2.7. It's kind of brilliant. I sort of love it.
This is like the difference between using imperial standard measurement versus metric measurement.
This is the two Americans in the room here realizing the importance of the metric system, right? So to everybody who listens to us overseas, we get it. We understand. But really, it is. It's a very intuitive thing. And I'm honestly, the next time it comes up, I'm going to advocate for a 10 pixel base font and then use that as the rem calculation on everything, because man, talk about making it easy. Like, and I don't know if you do this, Aaron, but when I when I'm working on a SAS file and I'm trying to calculate a particular font size, I always do the comment out to the side that is like, you know, this is 1.125 RAM and it's meant to be 18 pixels. And because
I do something like that.
Yeah, because you need that reference for other people and everything. But yeah, I mean, this eliminates that need. It's silly. It's such a weird, like, small thing. But man, that attention to detail, absolutely speaks volumes to the folks who have built this. And my hat's off to them, because I don't think I've ever read an article from Chris Coyer or Ethan Marcotte or any of these folks that have advocated for a 10 pixel base font and justified it that way. And if they've written that and I missed it, I apologize. Don't scream at me, but
you should check it out. The link's in the show notes.
It's a good font too. Let's just say that, because we didn't mention that. The font is a perfectly good font.
It's super here. I can actually just read the URL because it's that easy. It's v2.designsystem.digital.gov. That's it. v2.designsystem.digital.gov.
Yeah.
It's cool. Check it out.
So, okay, let's see here. It's worth noting that this isn't like a little niche product that isn't being used anywhere. The digital services have worked hard to roll this out within the federal government of the United States. They've now got it on like 200 websites. Which, I mean, the federal government has, I think, a lot more websites than people realize.
Oh my gosh, yes.
But yeah, and we'll have a link in the show notes. They have a list actually on their documentation of every place they have rolled it out. And it's everything from the White House uses it, the VA uses it, it's deployed on parts of health.gov. All of these different departments of agriculture and folks like that have it, as well as lots of like fringe sites and small services and things and one-offs that get produced now all start with that as the base layer. And I even remember, Aaron, talking to you a few months back about this, and you were real excited about the idea of like trying to introduce this, because you worked and you were a government contractor. And so it was like this idea of, hey, let's look at bringing this into our work since it's already kind of a government standard.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was the people that I talked with on my team at the time, they were aware of it, and they were working on changing out some of our templates for it, too.
And based on the 2.0 rollout, part of what they're emphasizing is it's easy to adapt to. So it's not a matter of bringing it in and changing your whole website. It's a matter of bringing it in and accommodating the website and adapting it over time to the new features. Which makes it a good starting point, and a good starting point for anybody trying to build a website at that point or update a website. You know, if you go from using, you know, your own code to something like Bootstrap or Foundation, you frequently find yourself having to rewrite your entire website. And they have tried. There's going to be a video actually in the show notes of this where they, and it's a video from a couple months ago when they were still beta testing this, but they talk a lot about, you know, this ability to scope the CSS and do things that limit its ability to leak into your existing design so that you only use the parts of it you want. And they were very cognizant of that. And again, back to this credit, like, this was built by people who get it. They understand these challenges that we have as boots on the ground.
It's awesome.
So this idea of design systems certainly isn't new, and not new in government even. You had mentioned to me a presidential candidate for this year, and he has a funny name. That's all I remember.
It's the way that
I do remember. It's the marketing campaign. Butt edge edge.
It's boot edge edge.
Is it boot edge edge or is it butt edge edge? Because
boot.
I'll tell you. The marketing thing literally says butt edge edge.
I think the t-shirts say boot edge edge, don't they?
I buy me a t-shirt and I'll wear it. That's all I'm gonna say.
This isn't to say I advocate for him or anything. This isn't an endorsement at all.
I'm just literally aware never heard of him. The guy.
Yeah. He's got a he made some press recently where there was kind of a media like about the design system that his campaign rolled out.
Yeah, like, and to be clear, like, this is in Fast Company. It's not just like some random Slashdot article or something like that. Like, there, what they did made Fast Company, and so we'll have a link to that as well in the show notes. So check that out, because yeah, it's neat to say the least.
Yeah, the design system, it's basically just a color palette set and maybe like some graphics and just some like pre-made marketing collateral that can be used by like you and I or anyone who wants to endorse or campaign this particular candidate. I'm only briefly going to mention this, but there was also a Twitter clapback because Mina Markham, I hope I'm saying her name right, she had done a design system called Pantsuit for the Clinton campaign. And there was a bunch of people who were like, you know, Pete's not the first person to do a design system. And rightfully so, like, she legitimately did one for that campaign. And I guess you found a book, Designing Obama, by Scott Thomas.
Yeah. So
I don't know if this is a design system, but it's similar.
It's I think it definitely qualifies. This goes back a fairly long way in terms of, you know, web technology, certainly. This goes back to the original Obama campaign in 2008. Scott Thomas put out his book, Designing Obama, where they went into, like, everybody remembers that O logo. But the design concept that they had for the campaign overall was certainly much bigger than that. The book's like 338 pages. It is a comprehensive look at the way they approached design and branding for that campaign. Not just online, of course, you know, it covered the spectrum. But that was maybe one of the first really big political sort of like, hey, we're actually putting thought into this marketing camp. Like, let me ask you, name one thing associated with George W. Bush from a marketing standpoint. Logo, design, colors, aside from red, white, and blue.
W. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, what was the Georgie marketing Dubs. Anchor of his campaign?
Yeah.
And I challenge anybody to tell me, because I honestly, I don't remember anything about his campaign, and I'm old enough to remember, so. But Obama came out with this idea of hope, right?
Yeah.
The hope branding, and the O, and the way, not just the colors that were used, but the specific color blue, that sort of mix between a powder and a royal blue that he used.
Right.
There was a specific texture that they used in some of the backgrounds and things like that. And so this book goes into that, but it was this first real dive into this idea of using a design system. What Butt Edge Edge is doing, Boot Edge Edge, I'm going to have to say it both ways now because I don't know. You know, they have released their design system as a utility, effectively, and said, here are the colors that define us. You know, here are the ways we present our brand, and here's a tool set you can use to show your support for us so that anybody can create a logo for his campaign to an extent.
And see, I think that is really cool. And I think that this is something that we can perhaps extend beyond just Pete's campaign and beyond just politics in general. You know, like you and I used to work in higher ed, and I don't know what your campus was like, but on our campus we had a style guide with branding guidelines, and they were really strict about it. You know, central communications was like, you will only use the I and the U in this image, literally this ping file that we're giving you. You only use these Pantone colors for print and like you'll use these fonts, etc. You have to pay us for them, etc. But it was a lot of like really technical marketing stuff that if you're not a trained designer, like, you know, are you, do you know what a Pantone color is? Like,
it was a strict style guide.
Yeah. Yeah. But it used a lot of like lingo and a lot of industry jargon. This doesn't. This says like, these are the colors we like. These are the, like, here's the names for them that we're calling them. And here's the hex colors, because you'll need those. But this is the colors. And, you know, if you want to do stuff that's on brand for us, these are the colors you'll use. This is some images you can use. We've made this vector art for you already. It's like we're kind of like in the age of memes right now, right? Like everyone's creating stuff. We're all creating images and content and whatever else, whether you're doing an image macro or a weird YouTube video or whatever, like people create stuff now. And so this is giving people the correct configuration and settings, because if they want to do it, they want to support your campaign, they want to use the correct colors. And if you just give them that correct colors and that information, they'll use it.
Yeah, this kind of overlaps with the broader scheme of what a design system is. And what Pete has done is a very good interpretation of a design system, which is producing a means of not just enforcing your branding, but producing things based on it that are inherently in compliance with that branding. Right? So it gets into what we talk about for what a design system is. Design systems are a confluence of the philosophy and values that drive you as an organization, which, like you quoted from the WDS, they've got six design philosophies that anchor what they built. The styles that go along with that. Styles are an abstract expression of the colors, you know, the branding, the voice, the things that define you culturally. And then the patterns. The patterns are the implementation of those things. You know, they are the strict... Well, and so the one thing that US WDS 2.0 said, we're releasing practical design tokens. They use the phrase tokens. Tokens are that sort of abstraction and application of patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll throw a link in the show notes to the design principles as well, because I think those translate all that really well. But that's really what we get to, because at the end of the day, design systems help developers. They help designers, absolutely. But what they really help are the people who bring you the things to design and to develop.
Yeah.
The things you are going to have to build.
And for a campaign, especially one that's positioning itself as kind of grassroots, ostensibly, this one, their design toolkit offers, logos, the colors, like I mentioned before, type, so like which fonts to use. And then there's a thing called Team Pete, and that has designed state named, like your state, so New York for Pete or whatever.
Right.
Has like a logo for your state. But if your organization, and so if your university campus or your, I don't know, local sports team or whatever, if you want to allow your fans or your supporters to show their support, this is a really cool way to do that. You just tell them this information and you make it publicly available and say like, hey, show up like wearing your best design or your best t-shirt or sign or whatever. And here's the stuff you need to know about us.
Yeah. So what this is all designed to do is get you to the point as a developer or a designer that you can deal with the ad hoc work that comes your way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've had a problem with for the last 15 years is stuff coming to me that styles are easy. A style guide is actually very simple in a lot of cases. Let's take Pepsi.
Mm-hmm.
The Pepsi style guide is very simple. The Pepsi font is extremely distinctive. You know that that's a thing that Pepsi uses. The color blue and the color red they use in their logo is very distinctive. It's very specific. It's something that's going to be expressed through the work. And so if somebody is contracted outside of Pepsi to help build a landing page, let's say, it's mm-hmm. very easy to tell them, use this font, use these colors, you know, here's our voice, whatever. Where it gets harder is then when that gets handed off to a developer.
Yeah.
Or a designer to refine it or whatever the case may be, because it starts to impact, and you'll see this much, much more in larger organizations. In all fairness, folks who work freelance, you know, I don't know what to tell you. You can certainly have an internal design system that you use. You can develop design systems for the folks you contract with.
Mm-hmm.
Small organizations don't care. You know, I mean, for better or worse, they don't, because they're small, and that's not the value that they bring. But at any kind of larger organization, if you can hand off a design system to that third party,
mm-hmm.
it is kind of a contract into the reliability and confidence of your workflow. Because one of the things, and this is where things get gnarly, is I've worked with my company for 7 years. It's a large organization. We have many brands, not just one brand, but the brands are related. And so we run into problems because each brand is, of course, distinct, but connected. And so what we've been after is this very nice balance of each brand needs a style guide, certainly, but our design principles, our design philosophy are at an organizational level, not at a brand level.
Right.
And our pattern library needs to be at an organizational level, because what we get is, you know, if one part of our company goes out and contracts with a third party to bring in a design for a landing page or something, and they come in with, let's say, a 50-50 panel that has an image on one side and content on the right side or something like that, I mean, we internally have already developed some solutions to that. But if that other group doesn't know that, and we don't have any, like, defined value, organizational value attached to that layout, they mm-hmm. give us something else. Now we're stuck maintaining two different 50-50 panels that are maybe close, but not quite. The padding's a little different. The treatment of the image is a little different. And it results in an enormous amount of overhead to then maintain things that are effectively the same. That's one thing that when you bring in a design system, you can start to eliminate. Because when you contract with somebody, the first thing you do is you say, here is our system. It's like walking up to a kid and pouring a bucket of Lego blocks in their lap. There may be 1,000 Lego blocks in that bucket, but you know that the thing they build out of it is something that you can reproduce every time without going out to Walmart and buying more Legos.
Right, right.
That's the value of the design, at least to me. That's the value that I see in it.
It reminds me a little of... we had a social media consultant when I was at IU, Brad Ward, his name was.
Yeah.
And he said that he was telling some of our leadership, you know, like regarding social media and why we needed to be on that, was because people are going to be talking about you on various platforms, Twitter, Facebook, etc. And so, like, that's going to happen whether or not you like it. And so your participation in that online discussion is something you can opt into, and so you're affirmatively choosing to be part of that and to potentially steer it. And I think that that's sort of one of the advantages of creating a design system like this, is that, you know, if other people are going to create content or whatever for you regardless because they love your brand or whatever, you can at least make sure that they're getting your colors right, or getting your font right. Yeah,
because you want to reduce work at the tail end, and this is always that risk. And I'm going through that right now. I'm working on a project where what was designed entirely in a vacuum. It didn't take into consideration the technology being used, the CMS being used. It didn't take any of that into account. And yes, I can solve every problem that is presented in that design. But the difficulty associated with something like how the menu is presented, and this is one that actually comes up a lot, how a responsive menu is based on a mobile design versus a desktop design.
Right.
The mobile design was such that I couldn't use the markup that was generated because the system, it's WordPress, I don't know why I'm being cagey about it. WordPress's menu output has a very specific structure to it. And it's a very flexible and useful structure. But I couldn't produce the mobile navigation without either creating a second totally different menu or by adding on an enormous amount of extra JavaScript to completely rewrite the DOM to account for it. That's where these things like design systems come in, because you can account for all of that well ahead of time. You can adapt. You can know that these problems are there. And it silently kind of enforces a rule set upon the people who will then pick that up and use it. They don't need to care what CMS you're using or what output it has. All they know is, this is, you know, when I look at your design system, I can look at the pattern component of that and know this is the way menus are output. Or
right.
I can look at your accessibility standards and know that if I give you yellow text on a white background, that that is not something that you're going to find acceptable, you know. Those are the things that we strive for when we bring all of this together, because I think that in the end, it makes everybody better.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? I mean, even the most developeriest developers amongst us, you may never touch CSS. You may want to have nothing to do with it. But at least understanding the values that your company has, that directs the way that you build the thing that is coming next.
Like, I would say the hardest part of creating something is having that initial vision of going from nothing at all and then making those decisions to will something into existence. And so when you have a design system that's given to you, all those decisions are already made. And so now you have kind of a defined universe that you can work in, and it really simplifies the process a lot.
And there's another big piece to design systems, that something that has been argued, my God, I've been going to conferences as long as I've been a professional in this industry, and it's been a topic. Website redesigns. I almost got him. I almost got him.
Oh,
they are a waste of time and money. Website redesigns are the ultimate admission of failure from a strategy standpoint. The way you
except when they're necessary.
But if they become necessary, it is still out of failure. The only time that is not true is if your company has been bought by another company and you are forced to literally change the entire identity of your brand.
I'm thinking more of like, and this really doesn't apply that much anymore, but I'm thinking more of like, you know, in the early 2000s, you've got HTML that was written without CSS at all, and you have to implement CSS. Or it was implemented with CSS, but it wasn't done using modern best practices. It was done using crappy CSS or whatever. But like, sometimes technology changes, and there's new hotness out there.
Fair enough.
And it's just time.
Sure.
But that's not every year, though. And I think that some companies or organizations are like, every year they feel like they have to do an overhaul.
Yeah.
And it's like, why? Why would you spend that money?
And one thing like we have tried to do over the last few years to insulate us from that is we have worked very hard to kind of almost develop adversarially against our CMS, which is to say, like, we went out of our way to make sure every drop of code is in GitHub, is as built as part of a build process that goes through Jenkins and all of this stuff, and then gets deployed through scripts to the CMS, so that if the CMS ever changed, in theory, we could, you know, still work involved, but we could still inherently pick up what we have and bring it with us. But that's fair. That is a fair point. The bigger argument is this idea of in place, you know, just deciding we're going to redesign stuff because we're tired of it or whatever. And
yeah, the whole like homepage refresh thing that came up constantly.
Always, let's redesign the homepage. Let's redesign the templates. Let's fix this. And it's a failure because if you do your web development correctly, you should just always be iterating.
Yeah.
You should always be in a cycle of improvement and measuring and adjusting. And it's a very, I joke about it with my coworkers. We are an agile shop. But we are, of course, like anybody, we are a flavor of agile. We are we're not purely agile because nobody is purely agile at this point. But we do try to approach that idea of let's build something and then iterate on it. Let's make it work, get it out the door, and then measure it and then improve upon it. Let's not try to be perfect out the gate, and let's not build it and then wait 2 years before we touch it again.
Yeah.
We're not great at that yet, but we're trying.
I was just thinking, I think almost every time that I was told we needed to do a homepage refresh, it involved adding a carousel.
Yeah.
If you have whatever your homepage may look like on your organizational site, like you probably have places that can have content swapped out, like images changed and maybe content modules replaced or whatever. And I don't think that that's fine. Like that's not what I'm talking about. And I don't think it's what you're talking about either. We're talking about like gutting the template completely and then rebuilding it from nothing. Or entirely changing the style guide whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, it comes back and let's tie this all up with a neat little bow. Cause when we go back to last week's discussion or last episode's discussion on web components, the idea is a good design system is organic and is constantly growing and changing with you so that while from today to next month, it's not different. But today to 6 months from now, you could see different changes, different improvements.
Adaptation. I would even extend that further with the talk about design philosophy earlier, that your design philosophy will kind of steer the growth of your design system. So like the design system would be the manifestation of that design philosophy.
Your,
right?
Your design system should be a reflection of the evolution of your users. Because your users will get smarter over time and change over time, and their abilities and capabilities will change over time. My God, we're giving Instagram to chimps. Talk about putting the perfect bow on this subject, right?
I want to see more animals using Instagram. I want to see, cluster these animals, like, can dolphins? Dolphins could probably use it if you gave them a way to interface with it.
I would think
dolphins
so.
Dolphins are smart. I want to know what other animals, like, I'm going to get my hamster out, and we're going to try using Instagram.
I've seen cats play the ant game on iPhones, you know, where they smash the ants. or frogs. You see the one with the frog trying to eat the ants on the screen? They have perceptive ability there. So, I guess that is clearly the end of this episode at this point. I don't think we can end it better than that. So at any rate, look at design systems. Go look at what you can do there and think about them that way because they are designed to be a growth mechanism for your organization. You should be able to evolve them and change them and adapt them.
You know what? I don't mean to bury the lead on this, but I learned about architectural design records today, ADR. Have you heard of this before?
I do not have a clue what the hell you're talking about.
Okay, maybe we need to have another, like, maybe this deserves a lengthier discussion on an episode, but it is related to what we were just talking about. So, a design system's for the front end, right? Like, you know, HTML and CSS and onwards, that layer. So, the architectural design record is for the back end decision.
Right.
It's a kind of a log or historical archive of decisions that were made about your software architecture for your application or system. Sure. There's a really cool GitHub page that has a lot of like explanation about this. I just learned about it this morning. It's really neat. I haven't read a lot about it, but maybe we could talk about it more in another episode because I think it's a really cool concept.
It's that reminds me, I had a conversation earlier today with some folks from a company that I think this sounds very similar, right? That they are working with a company, it's a legacy company, so the company has been around for decades, and it's a large, publicly traded organization, And their consumer system, their customer system, their CRM is DOS based. Which, in fairness, I've talked to folks who have had like Fortran based systems that are still out there. Or if anybody's ever used InfoBasic, I know a place where that is still in use.
Right.
They've got this DOS based system that they have to run emulated because not only is the company that built it out of business, but the companies that came in to support it after the fact are out of business. And so they're stuck trying now to figure out how to bridge the gap. Costco is a company that is in this position, actually. Costco's like inventory management system is all command line, DOS-based. It may not be DOS specifically, but it is command line of some flavor. But I can see immediately where you're going with that idea of let's apply the design system to the development side so that we know why technology decisions were made and things like that. That's
so the main website that, I mean, at least from the discussion that I was in, is adr.github.io. And I'll add a link to the show notes.
Yeah.
There. But
yeah, do
just, yeah, it's pretty cool. And I want to learn more about it. And I think that it definitely, I've been worked on far too many apps where I come into it and I'm told like, oh man, if you could document some stuff as you're learning it, that would be great, because we don't have that. So
my direction to Aaron this week is going to be to go figure out who the key contributor is to that repo, and we're going to get him on the show. That's my goal. Yeah. By the end of the year, we're going to get that person on, because
I'll see if I can find them. That would be really awesome.
No, that's very interesting, and it's something that just goes to show that we'd speak a little off the cuff here. That didn't come up in our pre-plan, so that's very cool. Folks, stick with us. We're going to go to a break for just real quick, give you a little commercial, do that thing. Then we're going to come back, and we're going to wrap up, and I guess then we'll leave. Hell, I don't know. The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at nucloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux. Everybody, thanks for joining us this week on the Drunken UX Podcast. Hey, if you have a topic that you'd like to hear us cover at some point, feel free to drop by the website, drunkenux.com, click the contact link in the main navigation, and you can submit the form there. And if you want to hear us talk about something that's important to you, let us know. I'd love to hear what you want to hear us drink, scotch and vodka and whatever else may be. I don't know. Hey, Aaron, save me.
Yes. Oh. So, you know that Twitter thing we were talking about earlier? We're on there. Did you know
occasionally.
That? It's twitter.com/drunkenux.
More and more, unfortunately. I'm having to commit more time to that. It's a blessing and a curse.
Facebook.com/drunkenux. And then Instagram, where the chimps hang out. All the chimps are our fans. Instagram.com/drunkenuxpodcast. And and Slack, drunkenux.com/slack.
All the places. We are a popular bunch of people, and we love talking, mostly because we love hearing the sound of our own voice. I mean, I do anyway. Folks, genuinely, thanks for tuning in this week. If you have anything you want to hear coming up, we've got a bunch of stuff coming up that you're going to want to tune in for, from book reviews to interviews to guests and other topics. I promise you, it'll be worth your time. Otherwise, I think I only have one thing left to say, and that's before May gets here, I guess just keep your personas close and your users closer. Bye-bye.
Later.